welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
That ground's coming pretty big in the window now, and gotta find out what's going to happen. Is this the end for poor Steve?
I think it is.
Hal, bring us up to speed on minute 108.
And I'm just thinking of the poor sperm whale and bowl of petunias from Hitchhikers.
Oh no, not again!
The sperm whale, yes, oh no, the petunias. Oh no, not again! And the sperm whale. What's that big thing coming at me? It's big. It needs a big, wide name like Ground. I'll call it Ground. That's so enthusiastic and tragic. But anyway, I'm getting this all out of my system now because this is such a hard minute.
Downer, yeah. It's
a downer.
Yeah. Yes. I get it. Yeah. The yoke's on you. No,
come on, dads. Let's do this. All right. Minute 108. Aboard the Valkyrie, Steve Rogers steers the massive aircraft toward the ice-covered Arctic Sea, the frozen expanse filling the cockpit windows. His voice crackles over the radio to Peggy Carter. I'm going to need a rain check on that dance. All right, Peggy replies, her voice steady despite the strain. A week, next Saturday, at the Stork Club. You got it, Steve says, a faint smile in his tone. 8 o'clock on the dot, Peggy insists. Don't you dare be late. Understood? You know I still don't know how to dance, Steve admits. I'll show you how, Peggy says softly. Just be there. The icy surface looms closer, white against the setting sun. We'll have the band play something slow, Steve adds. I hate to step on your... The radio cuts to static, his voice gone. Steve. Steve, pleads Peggy. In the Hydra base control room, Peggy's breath catches, a tear tracing down her cheek. Colonel Phillips stands nearby, his voice grim as the silence lingers. Ugh, so hard.
Yeah.
Wow. I have questions. Hal, you being a pilot, so you're the closest pilot around. So,
hooray!
I know there's a way that after you've been flying so many hours and looking out the window and stuff like that, you can pretty much tell. You don't have to look at your altimeter to know you're at 1,000, 2,000, or 5,000 feet generally, right? I mean,
right? Yeah, you get
barns
a pretty good,
look smaller.
Yes, pretty good feel for it.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out if, I guess Steve hasn't been flying much, except for the time when he piloted the bomb into the other plane.
Right.
But he wouldn't have any idea about how far he has to go. I guess he's just waiting for the inevitable boom.
Well, I think to a degree, and especially given the fact that we're looking down at water and I'm not sure if this is coastline or like, well, it must be coastline because of, we know where he lands, but I thought, well, maybe there's some icebergs and there's things that are, if you look down and if you saw a city with a bunch of cars, you know, that's a familiar frame of reference, but just looking down at the expanse of the ocean is going to be harder for anybody to judge. And looking down at just a snowy landscape and things, it's going to be tough to judge, but instinctively, you know, as more and more of the ground is filling your peripheral vision when you're pointed straight at it, he's going to have a pretty good sense. But obviously he didn't know exactly when it was going to happen because he didn't finish his sentence.
He was talking all the way down, I think, but I agree with Hal. It's a pretty featureless void. He's basically diving into a sheet of white paper next to a sheet of blue paper, you know?
Yeah. The other thing I noticed as we're watching the giant panoramic view out the window, there's a missing strut in the middle right-hand side of the screen, and it's very your eye pulls right toward it. It looks like there's an overlay almost of something that got knocked out in a parallelogram.
That's exactly what it looks like. It's a VFX thing. Was that ever broken in a fight?
I think one of the things that were like stuff being scattered all around. It might have been when the Tesseract broke.
Yeah.
That there was a bunch of stuff flying around the cabin, but I thought that my impression, this being a German aircraft, that those were frames around individual window panes.
Right. So, that would be traditional, how what the construction would be. So if there's a broken frame, there would be missing glass, and we're not hearing wind rushing in.
Yeah, I mean, it is his hair is kind of moving a little bit, but not enough where he's got, you know, I was picturing this as like a 300 knot gust banging right. against that big flat window he's got in front of him.
Yeah,
I was wondering if it's a window in back of a window, like there's some. It looks like there's some kind of a balcony in front of the instrument panel that you can look down, and there's like yet another layer. But I may be misreading that.
It's hard to say. I mean, yeah, there's a sense that with that elevated central pilot seat, and then you've got seats off to the side, those wraparound windows, you could almost convince me that there is a floor below, like there would be in, say, B-17 or B-25, yeah. where you'd be down below, and then you'd have a navigator or a bombardier with that front view. But it doesn't look like that goes down far enough. It looks like it's just, you know, down about his feet level. And again, an interesting arrangement. You've got a single center seat pilot, and then definitely a seat to the left, and it certainly looks like one to the right as well.
Yeah, like a helmsman and an engineer or something, or a navigator right. or something. But
yeah.
We know what happened to those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Hans, so Hydra's yeah. hiring at this point, as we know.
Two job but, openings.
Exactly. Not to mention the bomb pilots.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, but that missing frame thing, I hate to say it, it honestly looks to me like more of a VFX thing, just the way the brakes are so clean versus a
yeah know, it's a, that but I mean there's
structural thing,
there's no way to make it like not clean, like I it's if you cut sections off of one of the struts, yeah. it's gonna outline a shape no matter what you do with it,
right? But as when you say overlay, it just
yeah.
something about your eye makes it look, you know, not like something's missing, but like something is painted over the top of it. And it just happens to be the exactly. background that's yeah. painted over the top of it. You would think if it were structural damage, these things are pretty rigid. And if they are individually framed pieces of glass, which would be plausible given the technology in the era and the German designs, then I could see those frame pieces staying pretty well in place, but you would think if it was damaged, something would be bent. It would have a jagged edge instead yeah. of more just of a clean cut.
That yeah, the frame themselves would bend out. Yeah.
Yeah. It could just be a mistake.
Brian, I don't, does Joe make mistakes?
Joe doesn't make mistakes. No, no.
He just has creative choices.
And they're two different, like, there's a close-up down around second 22. There's a close-up out the window, and it looks like it looks like a much different window frame than the one that's down around the 45 or so.
I see him looking similar. I just wonder, since we're zoomed in so much tighter in that close-up, that yeah. we're getting some fish
yeah that's a different so part the- of the different yeah. part of the windshield. I think we can, we're meant to see that as battle damage. That's how yeah. I interpreted it. From the energy or from the Skull and Steve slugging each other around. Yeah.
And in that close-up, if you go through it carefully, the sort of the top two canopy panels on the right side show some scratches and oh, some yeah. crazing yeah. and stuff. So
yeah,
you'd certainly believe it would be some damage.
Yeah.
But it's just that other one is really interesting, and I really wish you'd never shown me that, Jim.
I ruined another one for you.
That's not how that should look. Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting detail. But it's all here in my book.
Subliminally, it's all here in my upcoming book, How to Unsee Something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in the 2 seconds we see this as the movie's flying by, I think it just reaches battle damage is all.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Interesting. I had a couple thematic thoughts, and I thought I really wanted to take this opportunity, if it's all right with you guys, to sort of look at the MCU versus the comic books, because what this is setting up, or this second illustrates, is one of the two great tragedies of Steve Rogers' life. One is losing Bucky, and the second is leaving Peggy behind as he's frozen in an iceberg. That's something that the MCU did uniquely. In the comic books, losing Bucky was the great tragedy, the great guilt that Steve bore after he was defrosted. Bucky didn't come back to life for, gosh, 40, 50 years after that. Bucky was dead. And Bucky was a teenager for whom Steve felt responsible. He wasn't a peer. He wasn't someone Steve grew up with. He was a kid who got adopted by Steve's army camp and became sort of the camp mascot and then Steve's Captain America's partner. So in the comic books, Captain America's trauma was all revolved around Bucky. There was none of this great love story, this Peggy Carter thing. And boy, this movie just piles it on. Just this double tragedy of Steve Rogers' life that he's going to face going on in subsequent movies and such. And I think these are interesting and probably in the end, good decisions that they made when they were drafting the MCU. We got to remember this is still the early days of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but man, they were thinking ahead. They were thinking ahead to the Winter Soldier, which I've frankly never agreed with since it showed up in the comics, but you know, I take it as a fait accompli and if they were going to do it, I think this is the right way to do it about as well as it could have been done. But gosh, they were just piling the tragedy on a poor Steve Rogers here. And it really makes him a sympathetic character that we already love the guy. Right. But now I think we're going to care about him a lot from this point on.
Yeah.
And you wonder if it's already enough that he's destined for this fish out of water existence, the frozen and then being reawakened. He's already guaranteed to lose everybody. But as you say, the death of Bucky and then the fact that things had just started to sort of gel with him and with Peggy and, you know, clearly you're going to be the love of his life. And then just, oh, sorry, fate has other plans. And, you know, it would be bad enough if it was, you know, if he were just completely unattached and, you know, didn't really have many friends and things like this. And you froze him and then woke him up later. That's hard enough.
Which is more or less how the comic books went.
Okay. So it makes sense. It's interesting too. You're talking about, Bucky's role in the comics. Cause in the Howling Commando series is a similar character. I'm not thinking of his name, but he's a young, like a Dutch teenager. And the commandos kind of adopt him. He becomes a bit of a mascot and is around the base a lot and everything else. And there's a tragedy there for that kid because he gloms onto the commandos because his dad is a collaborator with the Nazis. But what he doesn't know, what the reader finds out, but the kid can't know because nobody can know, is that dad's a double agent and is actually working for the good guys all along. Wow. But kids looking for, you know, other father figures and stuff like that. So it was definitely something, you know, there was a theme. And I don't think like it was with Robin and perhaps you can tell me, Brian, if it was truly the case with Steve and Bucky, this kid doesn't seem like he's there in these stories to be the proxy for the youthful reader. You know, to appeal to you, it just seems like he's just this sort of tragic extra character. He's not prominent enough to say, oh, that's the kid I want to be. And his story is always just so far as I'm reading through these again, so really tinged with sadness. But, you know, was Bucky somewhat of a Robin analog? I mean, did he come in to connect with the youth?
Yeah, in the 40s and early 50s, in the original comic books, he was totally a Robin. That was the point of him, was to be Captain America's Robin. All the sadness, all the tragedy, the tinging and the responsibility and the father-son relationship, that came later on in sort of the Marvel Renaissance of the 60s. That was right. Stanley writing and Jack Kirby drawing, and they created that. They gave the depth to that relationship later. In the 40s and 50s, it was just quite shallow. And, Steve and his little buddy going out and fighting Nazis.
Right.
After the war, whatever evil came their way. I just thought there was one other connection in the comic books between Steve's pre and post frozen life. And that was Nick Fury. Yeah. Nick Fury led the Howling Commandos. Steve, Captain America worked with Nick Fury in World War II. And when he was originally defrosted, it was 1963, Avengers issue number 4. Nick Fury was still alive. He was older, but he was alive. And he became Steve's mentor in this new world, kind of his guide to say, okay, well, come on over here, buddy, join S.H.I.E.L.D. and we'll get you going. And of course he joined the Avengers immediately as well, but he had Nick Fury, and the MCU couldn't make that work, of course, because instead of 15 years or 20 years difference, we're talking about 70 years, and that's not going to work. Yeah. But just a reminder that Nick Fury led the Howling Commandos.
Yep.
Just not in the movies.
That's the comic, Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. And in fact, when these MCU films were first starting out, I show you my ignorance of so much of the Marvel comics, which I've since gotten into a lot more. I remember asking my buddy Eric, guest on this show, I said, wait a minute, you know, Fury, are they supposed to somehow be the same guy? Is that Fury? Was he the Sergeant Fury? And, you know, Eric trying to explain to me, and, you know, it was a flash, you know, this is in what, 2010, 2011. And it was a flashback to, you know, probably the very late 70s when I'm asking my proxy big brother, Eric, now tell me again, where this thing where babies come from, explain, how does that work? I don't understand any of this. So anyway, but yeah, and it was, wouldn't you have loved to have been a sort of fly on the wall in the meetings when they're sort of breaking this down and brainstorming, how do we have Nick Fury in the modern era? Or we've already established him in the modern era at the end of Iron Man. Or I was that Iron? Yeah, that was
Iron Man.
End of Incredible Hulk, or they went to the Hulk film, because there's the stinger there where we see him in Iron Man, but we also saw him in Hulk prior to that. Hulk and Robert Downey Jr. Right?
I don't remember that.
No, there was a
brief.
You might be right.
It could be,
anyway,
yeah.
But regardless, we've already, at this point, we've established Nick Fury is a modern day thing, and they. You know, I'm glad they didn't do the father and son thing, because that was much better fit for Howard and Tony Stark.
Yeah.
You
know, I knew your dad, now I knew this. And, you know, I mean, it wouldn't have been implausible to have more dads. It's like, oh, I worked with your dad and I worked with your grandfather. But, you know, that gets, you can only stretch that so far.
They'll turn into Nepo babies, and that's the worst. Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a lovely little scene they filmed for the first Avengers movie that, again, was excised, and I wish they'd included it in the movie. It's Steve Rogers going through dossiers of all the people he used to know, and you see him flipping through and opening up, and Howling Commando deceased, General, what's Tommy Lee Jones' name?
Colonel Phillips.
Yeah. Colonel Phillips deceased, and he opens up the Peggy Carter file, and it just says something like, retired. So he knows, he learns in the first Avengers movie, she's still alive out there somewhere. Oh. And it's just a lovely little grace note. I wish they'd included it, because it really plays up his loneliness and his out of timeness. And it's a neat depth to the character that would have taken them 20 seconds to put in the movie, and they decided not to.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what I was trying to figure out, and we're trying to deal with reality with a guy that's about to be frozen in ice, but Peggy's discussion with Steve at the end here is, she's saying, you know, I'll meet you next Saturday at the Stork Club. Now, maybe she knows that will never happen, but the Stork Club's in New York. She's somewhere east of Berlin, and he's in a plane that's coming down over the Arctic Ocean. I'm just trying to figure out why would she pick the Stork Club when they were all in London? And I would, you know, she could have said the Savoy Hotel or something. Yeah. But
she figured Steve could swim to it.
Yeah.
Just swim over to Manhattan.
Get in that boat that says New York and then jump out at the end, and it's right there on, you know, 53rd Street.
You know, presumably at some point, I mean, she knows that's where the airplane was headed. So,
it's obvious to me that they both of them knew this wasn't going to happen, that right. This was not a date that either of them would be making. This is romantic patter, and it's lovely.
Yeah. And heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's rough. I wanted to share a personal story. When I was a kid, I lived not too far from Manhattan. We used to go back in the day. It was easy for kids to just jump on a train and go to Manhattan. And, I had a I wanted to see the Stork Club, and so I had a matchbook that had the address, and it was on East 53rd Street. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna go see the Stork, and it was like, I don't know, 12. And so I'm walking down the street looking for the Stork Club, and I find a hole in the middle between two buildings, and it was CBS, the fellow that owned the Stork Club was a guy named Billingsley, and he was going broke, and he sold the property to CBS, and because CBS had run a radio show called the Stork Club, and they bought it from him, but they decided to turn it into William Paley Park. William Paley was the founder of Columbia, the Columbia Broadcasting System, and so they decided, well, we'll put a park here instead of the, then they tore the Stork Club down, and there was nothing to see, and I thought. Ah, and this was, of course, before the internet. So the only way I could have found out that it wasn't there anymore was going there.
That's a lovely, that's a neat story. You know,
yeah, so
and your
sad.
story, you know, I think is an answer to the question, why did Peggy mention the Stork Club? I think maybe she mentioned the Stork Club because she knew Steve had grown up in New York and had probably never had the money to go there himself. Had probably looked up to it like you know, Shangri-La or Valhalla or you know some mythical place that rich fancy people went to, and maybe she was connecting to him knowing he was a New Yorker.
He could have
Well, and
won.
they met in New York too.
Yeah, that's true.
So
That's true. In Brooklyn, where he got beat up there and there. I was thinking they could have won Hal's heart over if he said, why not the South Sleaze Club while you're dreaming?
yes, while you're dreaming, I have a regular table if you're not too bored with it.
Worlds
Yeah,
colliding.
or you could have also gotten me by saying you're going to you know going to sail across on the Queen Mary. Although by this point in the war, we're if the Queen Mary is not the gray ghost, we're actually very close to it. So that would have had to wait a little while too before she was back in proper you know canard transatlantic
Livery, yeah.
livery and
Well,
yes.
when you think about it, I mean, at this point in the movie, the war's not over. We haven't had VE Day yet. So
No.
Steve goes into the ice not knowing that his side won, which is interesting.
Yeah, and it's still 43, so he hasn't even known about Normandy.
D-Day, and that is interesting, because, you know, as we'll discuss later, maybe we save this for then, but you know, waking up and the things they're doing to try to ease his transition into modern times. But you would think that would be like as soon as he realizes some time has passed, you know, you'd think that'd be one of the first things. What happened?
Did
You
we
know,
win?
did we win? Everybody's speaking English around me. That's a good sign. You know, we're not all speaking German or Japanese, but still.
That's one of my favorite insights into studying and learning history is that you have to remember whenever you're looking at the past, the people living then didn't know how it was going to turn out. And
Yes.
I've told my daughters this in the context of, say, Apollo 11 and something. I sit down, I say, you have to remember when we saw that rocket go up, we didn't know they were going to succeed. It was just pulse pounding. The suspense was immense, unendurable. And one of my favorite anecdotes about World War II was a friend of mine has a mother who lived through World War II. And he was asking her, you know, tell me stories about World War II. And he expected kind of dashing, charming things. And all she talked about was just the stress because she said, you have to remember, at the time, we didn't know we were going to win.
Right.
And that just hits you like a 2x4 to the head when you realize, yes, because you know we've had moments like that. 9/11, we didn't know it was going to happen. You know, after the planes hit the tower, we didn't know if that was the start of something. We didn't know. We were in history, and when you're in history, the future is an un can be an uncertain, scary, unknowable proposition that only settles into certainty, only seems inevitable in retrospect.
That's such a fantastic point, and I think I've had that very same conversation. And when I look at something like, you know, take something like the Titanic, for example, and you know, the movie comes out and it's you know, it has its flaws, but big, beautiful, visually beautiful film, and you know, through the lens of hindsight, you look at, oh, those idiots, what are they thinking? They're getting on the Titanic for crying out loud, you know, obvious that nobody would do that. But I think, you know, a film like that, can be very valuable, even if it plays a bit fast and loose with some accuracy. It can be very valuable if it can put the viewer in that mindset again. Like, yeah. Wait a minute, they didn't know these things were going to happen, and they had no reasonable reason to think that they were. And when you're talking about World War II and that stress, that hits home even harder when you consider that 39 to the end of 41, we have this anxiety about, we're probably going to be in it. We're not in it. We're probably going to be in it. I hope we're not in it. Maybe we have to be in it. You know, that constant sort of thing. And then Pearl Harbor happens, and Japan and then Germany declaring war. But, you know, for the first 5 months of the war, it was just nothing but miserable defeat.
Yeah.
You know, so not only was we don't know how it's going to end, is we don't have any reason to expect we're going to win.
Yeah,
and you know,
we don't realize sometimes that we are living in history. I mean, right? Technically, right, here we are in 2026. We're living here before the first permanent moon base, and you know, people look back as like, you know, the people who didn't live on the moon, and it used to be dark on that side when the moon was in a crescent. You know, and it's like I've told this story before on another podcast, but. When just after 9/11, well, not just after, but maybe about 6 months after 9/11, I was living in a DC metro area, and we brought some school kids, middle school. My son was in middle school, and we brought some kids to the Museum of American History at Smithsonian, and they had one of the first displays about 9/11. They had the flag from the Pentagon. They had the cockpit recorder from Flight 93. And they had like things like entrance badges from the World Trade Center and firemen's walkie-talkies and cell phones and credit cards from people that were in the building. And we were going through this, and one of the kids said to me, "This isn't history. This just happened." And it took him a second, and he finally realized that everything in that building was at one time. This is what's happening now. This is what you're experiencing. And all the stuff that you're doing right now will someday, you know, even now or 25 years after that, someday be history that people will reflect on and say, well, what happened? We didn't know, like you said, what was happening next? What was the next target? Where was America going to go from here? What was going to happen in the world?
And you look back on that, you know, World War II is such an easy monumental example to fall back on, but you look back on that uncertainty and, you know, the commitment and the drive that it took to work toward the positive outcome, even when it either seemed impossible or highly improbable and all these things. But at least, you know that there's a chance. And if everybody pulls together and we have right on our side and all of these good things, but then, you know, now we come back to this minute, you look at the situation Steve is in, and there's nothing but the worst personal outcome for him in this situation.
Yeah.
But he still, you know, it just takes this very, very different level of courage and commitment to say, this is what I have to do.
What Steve would tell you, of course, is that he's no worse off than any of the thousands of guys who died on D-Day or anywhere else, right. You know, Battle of the Bulge. I mean, he's just, he sees himself as another soldier doing his job.
Something to
ponder. Anyway, we've got lots to talk about. We've down to the last 10 minutes. Oh my gosh. But if you would like to continue this conversation that we're having here, we're always available over at our great big, listeners base, Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like our show, and I know we're winding down, but don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. When you put in a like, you really help expand our audience, because the people look for well-liked episodes. So if you like this one, please do. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
can do this all day.